Hey everyone, welcome back to The Greek Current. I'm Thanos, and this week we're especially pleased to welcome Ms. Madeline Miller to our podcast. Madeline, welcome to The Greek Current.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
First, a little bit about Madeline. She's the author of the award-winning book, The Song of Achilles, and the New York Times number one bestseller, Circe. She has an extensive background in Latin and ancient Greek and the classics, has taught and tutored Latin, Greek, and Shakespeare to high school students for the past 20 years. And beyond her great books, her writing has also featured in The Guardian, The Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, The Telegraph, and NPR. So again, welcome and thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it is my pleasure.
As a lot of you know, and as we talked about on our last podcast, we are a couple weeks into our Give Greek campaign, a campaign that we set up to promote not only Greek products, but also things like books about Greece and its culture and history. On this episode, we're going to stick with the theme of our books and Homer, and discuss Madeline Miller's two books, The Song of Achilles and Circe, two books that I think should be on everyone's bookshelf and everybody's reading list, to be fair.
Thank you. But first,
I want to talk a little bit about Giving Greek, because when we were setting up the interview, Madeline, you actually told us that you've been practicing this for some time now.
It's true. One of my very, very favorite things to give is Greek teas. And there are a couple wonderful companies. The one I'm thinking of in particular is Crocus Kozanis. They do organic teas. Often one of my favorites is orange, honey, and saffron. So they make wonderful stocking stuffers. They're so delicious. So if you have any tea-loving people in your life, they're a great place to go. And then the other thing, Greek-themed thing that I'm giving this year in particular, is Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey, which is, I think, a fabulous translation, and really is going to engage a whole new generation of people with the Odyssey.
So a couple items, and including another book for you guys to take a look at. And we'll have to add those to our crowdsource page. We set up a page, Madeline, where anybody can jump in and add the business that they like, or, you know, the bookstore where you can buy these Greek items and make them your Christmas gifts. How did you get into Giving Greek, if you don't mind?
Well, I, you know, love Greece and I love tea. And so I had spent a summer on an archaeological dig there, and I had tasted saffron tea, which I'd never tasted before. And so when I came back, I kind of was doing some Google searches for it. And I found this wonderful company. But also, you know, I just love to, I feel like I have had so many pleasures in my life that have come from Greece. And so I love to support, you know, bringing more of that into the world.
Well, thank you very much. That sounds fantastic. And we'd love to hear about Corfu at another time too. But for this podcast, before we talk about the books, I want to take a step back and really dig in and find out, what is it about the classics that drew you in? And more specifically, what has attracted you to Homer? Because he seems to be the inspiration for the two books, the Song of Achilles and Circe.
Yes. So, I came to these stories quite young. I was actually sort of 5 and 6 when I started encountering Homer, and I encountered him because my mom would read me little snippets of the Iliad and the Odyssey in translation, of course, as bedtime stories. And I have
memory. My dad did the same thing.
Right? And it's amazing. They're so good. And for children, I feel like they're so gripping. At least they were for me. And, you know, I have a memory, and you probably have the same, of the first line of the Iliad. My mom reading that to me, the Sing goddess of the destructive rage of Achilles. And as a child, you just think, oh, who's this Achilles? Why is he so angry? What's happening in this story? And so I was totally drawn in. And then I think the more I read the myths and kind of dug into the stories, I was always shocked at how incredibly resonant they felt to modern day. People often say, you know, how do you make your books feel so relevant? I don't really think I'm doing anything. I think I'm just telling the story. And the story is itself so resonant because, you know, the ancients really understood human nature. And so many of these stories are about kind of universal human experiences of love and grief and going to war, hope and, you know, ambition, despair, all these things that we still struggle with, difficult family dynamics, you know, all these things that are still so much in our life.
And,
I think they just expressed it so beautifully. So to me, they have always felt real and now.
No, I completely agree with that, especially when it comes to the gripping stories that you read in the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Aeneid as well. Would you say that this early exposure to Homer kind of guided you into studying classics and the ancient languages, Latin and ancient Greek?
Absolutely. And so I went off to high school and I had I took Latin. I was desperate to take Latin. I didn't even think it was possible to take ancient Greek at the time, but my Latin teacher, I was very fortunate. He knew ancient Greek. He was also a classicist by training. And so he told me he could teach me ancient Greek. And so I signed up and he did in fact teach me ancient Greek. And getting to read the day, I can still remember the day that, you know, I read kind of the first 10 lines of the Iliad in Greek was a revelation for me because I had loved the stories so much in translation, but reading Homer's poetry in the ancient Greek was just a whole other experience. It was so beautiful. It was so arresting and powerful in the original. So after that, it was just, I was hooked. I was going to be a classics major.
And I think you've captured those, you know, how you describe those first 10 lines of the ancient and the ancient rendition of the Iliad and the Odyssey. I think you capture that in both of your books, which are fantastic adaptations of the originals. And they give the stories a fresh lens. In past interviews, I know you've said that you were once a classics purist, thinking that, you know, any attempts at making adaptations of the classics was kind of a slap in the face to the originals. Mm-hmm. What changed your mind? Because obviously these two books are great adaptations, I think, and worthy.
Oh, well, thank you. First of all, the whole time I was working on the Song of Achilles, it took me 10 years to write it. That was my first novel. I did not tell any of my classics mentors or peers what I was doing because I was so worried that they would, you know, hate me for it and think I was doing this terrible, blasphemous thing. But I think I came to get over that just by knowing the history of Homeric reception that, you know, as soon as, first of all, Homer himself, if he was, you know, a single person, came out of oral tradition. And so, you know, already these were stories that were being told and retold and retold and passed down and passed down, and different bards would emphasize different parts. And so the stories themselves already had kind of a flexible quality to them, even, you know, in the ancient world. And then, of course, there were so many other ancient authors who were retelling them. You know, the great tragedians, Sophocles, Aeschylus, and Euripides all touched on those themes. You see them, you know, echoed in Plato. Plato talks about Achilles and Patroclus, and just again and again, kind of down into the Roman world, Virgil, Ovid. So many people have retold these stories. And I love so many of those versions. I mean, I love the Aeneid, you know, as much as I love the Iliad and the Odyssey. Even though, you know, the Aeneid is kind of, you could even call the Aeneid fan fiction in a sense, you know, early fan fiction. He's saying, well, let's tell the story again, but from the Trojan side.
Right.
And so I think what I came to realize is that these stories have lived because they have been retold, that Homer is so wonderful. No one can hurt Homer. You know, the Iliad and the Odyssey are always going to be fine down through the centuries. They are brilliant works and nothing can take away from them. But that by telling and retelling these stories, hopefully we can bring people back to find the Iliad and the Odyssey anew. And so that, you know, reading the Aeneid immediately makes you want to go back and read the Iliad and the Odyssey, and reading Ovid's version makes you want to go back, and reading Margaret Atwood's Penelopeiad makes you want to go back. And so I think that ultimately it all, you know, all boats rise together.
Right. Tell us a little bit about the process of writing and researching these books. How much of it is based on the original text, which, to be honest, are limited, and how much is a result of your creative writing?
As I was thinking about these stories, I wanted to write fairly close to Homer because I wanted to be sort of in dialogue with Homer. And I think that when you're adapting these works, you don't always have to be as close as I was, but that was sort of what my vision was. I wanted to be writing very close. And so in both cases, I was taking a character who really does not have a lot of, you know, so-called stage time, and who's kind of a mystery in the original, and then expanding their psychological perspective. So in the first case, in the case of Song of Achilles, this was Patroclus, and he is the lover or best friend of Achilles, depending on which interpretation you're going with. I go with lover in the Iliad, and we hear some really fascinating details about him. We hear that he is, he's called always gentle, which is kind of a shocking description of an ancient Greek hero. Usually it's, you know, powerful, strong, good in battle, honorable, not gentle. And then there's another description of him where Menelaus describes him as being kind to everyone. Again, a very unusual description. And so, you know, and yet we barely see Patroclus. He's kind of always in the background. We hear he's Achilles' closest companion. And then we don't really see him until that moment when he puts on Achilles' armor and goes out to try and save the Greeks and chase back the Trojans by making them think he's Achilles.
Yeah, it's an interesting selection of character, I think, because when most people read the Iliad, you think, okay, beyond Achilles, who's the next character? Maybe, you know, Agamemnon, Diomedes,
right.
Ajax,
yeah.
But Patroclus seems like the character that's kind of, you only really hear much about him when he takes on Achilles' armor to fight Hector.
Achilles spends the whole first part of the poem saying, the only thing that matters to me is my reputation, and, you know, I'm not going to fight for the Greeks again until Agamemnon personally comes and apologizes. Nothing can change my mind. And then the moment Patroclus dies, that's all gone. And he's, you know, he immediately wants to go back into the battle and avenge Patroclus. And it turns out that there is something he cares about more than his reputation, which is Patroclus. And so to me, I sort of set that ending on the horizon and wrote towards it. I thought, you know, Homer shows us the end of their relationship so beautifully. But what's the beginning? How do you get to that moment where Patroclus' death just breaks open Achilles' world? And so I was sort of trying to answer that question.
Yeah, and if for those who have read the book and those who are thinking about it, when you first pick it up and you start reading, the first chapter of Song of Achilles, in fact, you barely even hear anything about Achilles. You just mentioned in passing by Patroclus, who's narrating the story.
Yeah.
Which is really fascinating to get the whole story from this character's perspective.
Yeah, and then the same thing with Circe. You know, she's just a cameo in the Odyssey. She's, you know, she's the witch who turns men into pigs. But she actually has gotten, I think, a really bad reputation. People always remember the pig thing, which I understand.
Right, give us a sense of who Circe was. I think, like you said, most simply recognize her as the witch who, you know, is a ruler of an island that Odysseus crashes onto and turns all his men into swine, and he has to figure out how to turn them back.
Yes. And that's really what drew me into her. So she's really interesting. First of all, she's the first witch in Western literature. And so that's really interesting because the witch is such a potent figure throughout history and literature, even up to today. I mean, what's amazing is modern female politicians on kind of all sides of the political spectrum still get called witches. So that word is still really powerful. And here Circe is the first one in the Western world. So that was really interesting to me. But part of what I wanted to do with her is sort of say, you know, I think she's gotten a bad rap because people tend to, you know, just remember the pigs, kind of see her as this villainous, you know, black widow spider at the center of the web, luring men in. But really, after the whole pig thing is resolved and she and Odysseus become lovers, she's incredibly helpful to him. And her island is the only place that he lands that he doesn't want to leave. His men have to push him to leave. So he actually legitimately is enjoying his stay there, unlike on Calypso's island, who he also visits, another nymph. She's Calypso's the one who holds him prisoner for 7 years. And so I thought, well, wow, you know, she's such an important part of the Odyssey, such an intriguing character, but we know so little about her. Why is she turning men to pigs? We have no idea. Homer doesn't say. You know, how did she come to be on this island? How did she come to her witchcraft? So all those were questions that I wanted to answer. But most of all, I really wanted to put her at the center of the story and make Odysseus the cameo. I wanted to kind of flip it. So she's in, you know, 2+ books of the Odyssey. So Odysseus is in 2+ chapters of my novel. It's kind of turnabout is fair play. So
well played. Yeah, Circe, I think you managed to tie her into a number of other myths as well, from the story of Daedalus and Icarus to Jason and Medea to the Minotaur. How are you able to weave all these characters together? And was there ample evidence that kind of pushed you towards making those connections in ancient texts? Or was it primarily, as you know, to repeat my other question, something as a result of your creativity?
So a lot of it was there, but I was filling in the gaps. So there is no myth about Circe going and delivering the Minotaur by C-section. Mm-hmm. Although as a writer, I think if you have the opportunity to write that kind of scene, you have to do it. But there is the story that Pasiphae, who's the mother of the Minotaur, was Circe's sister. So that existed. So to me, that was a real invitation to her sister's the mother of the Minotaur. Of course, she would have, you know, it makes sense for her to have an interaction then with that myth, and therefore with the Minotaur and with Daedalus as well, who's there to build the labyrinth to hold the Minotaur. And so I tried to look for moments like that. Her brother, Aeetes, is the father of Medea. And so again, you know, she's the aunt to both Medea and the Minotaur. So there was sort of a natural interaction there, I felt. She interacts with Prometheus, one of the great Titans. There's no myth with her interacting with Prometheus, but her father is Helios, the sun god, and her grandfather is Oceanus. And those two gods play an incredibly important role traditionally in the Prometheus story. And so putting her into it made sense because her father and grandfather are such a huge part of it. So I tried to look for moments like that where there were these opportunities where naturally, you know, she would be there, she would be part of that, she would at least have heard about it. You know, and she does spend a lot of her life on an island. And so it was a little bit of a challenge to kind of find how do I bring more interaction? A few of these myths were right out of the ancient literature. The Argonautica by Apollonius of Rhodes tells the story of Jason and Medea coming to Circe's island. And so that was, you know, he doesn't write the dialogue between them that I write, but that was coming right from there. But most of it was just me sort of making inferences from, you know, myths that she was already adjacent to.
And Circe's obviously a fantastic example of a female protagonist in the classics. And like you said, you've managed to flip it and make her the focus of the story. But while most of us kind of think of, when we talk about classics and the main characters, we think obviously of Achilles, Odysseus, Aeneas, Menelaus. How challenging was it to find information to make Circe the protagonist, but not only for Circe? Is it difficult to find female protagonists in the classical world? I mean, we're familiar with Helen of Troy and Medea and now Circe, but was there any literature that highlighted the role of women as the main characters?
I mean, you get more of that in tragedy, where the female characters can kind of come to the fore a little bit more, but certainly in the world of epic, it's always focused on the male heroes. There are some strong female characters in the Iliad and the Odyssey, but they are clearly kind of second and third tier. Achilles's mother, Thetis, the sea nymph, in the Odyssey, Penelope, Odysseus's brilliant wife, but they're almost more mysterious than they were if they were just names. They're sort of, we get these tantalizing hints about them, but then we don't get anything else. And so part of what I wanted to do is I had often felt reading this ancient literature that I wanted the female characters to be as vivid, as exciting, as flawed and complex as the male characters were. And so what I wanted to do is kind of take this character of Circe and give her the same scope that Achilles and Odysseus have, give her life the same attention. Achilles and Odysseus both make terrible mistakes. They bring destruction down on the people around them. I wanted Circe to also be able to make mistakes and, you know, learn from them and try and do better and struggle and all those things. So yes, I mean, I do feel that there are some, you know, Antigone is a wonderful female character. There are some of them out there, but in general is very heavily, particularly in the world of epic, very heavily weighted toward male characters. So it was fun to work with a character who was female and, you know, getting to do epic things like face six-headed monsters, just like Odysseus does, and, you know, interact with gods that are more powerful than she is, as Odysseus does, and have sort of very high stakes things. But I also wanted to bring in some things that were very traditionally female. You know, one of the things that to me is really interesting about epic is full of death. You know, there's always, in the Iliad, you get kind of death after death in very gruesome and gory ways. But one of the most epic experiences I can think of in life is actually birth. And there are no real birth scenes in epic literature because that was traditionally female. And so it wasn't sort of seen as important enough. And so Circe is a mother, and I wanted, you know, her motherhood to be an important part of her epic story as well. So I kind of wanted to include, not only did I want to put a female character into epic, but I wanted to take some of these sort of, you know, there's not a lot of diaper changing in the Odyssey, but I wanted to take kind of some of these female experiences and put them, you know, and give them their due as well.
Yeah. Are there any hints you can give us on what we can expect next from you?
So I'm thinking about the Aeneid a lot. You mentioned the Aeneid.
Mm-hmm.
I love Virgil's epic as well. It's very, very different from the Iliad and the Odyssey. And I'm really interested kind of more in the politics of it, that here you have Virgil. He was born into a republic and he died under a dictator. And during that time, the relationship to poetry and power really shifted. And, you know, I'm interested in sort of what it was like to live through that, and to suddenly have the emperor breathing down your neck about what you're writing, and, you know, how that may or may not be reflected in his work. So I'm sort of thinking about that. And the other thing I'm thinking about has nothing to do with the ancient world really at all, which is The Tempest. I love Shakespeare. I'm a Shakespeare director. And The Tempest has been kind of hanging out in the back of my mind for maybe a decade. So it might be time for The Tempest.
I think The Tempest is a great play. I remember reading it in college. So I'll look forward to that for sure. You're not only a scholar, though, and an author, but also an educator, as we mentioned early on. What do you see as the role of classics today, especially given the fact that many school programs have cut Latin and ancient Greek programs? And a lot of teachers, whether it be in English or literature, are allowing students to read much more contemporary literature, which isn't a bad thing, but they're pushing the classics to the side. Do you think there's still room for the classics in today's world? And how do you deal with it in the classroom?
I absolutely think there's still room for classics. And, you know, I would love for them to be there along with all that contemporary literature, which I think is also incredibly important. And I think that they can sit side by side beautifully, because oftentimes, you know, these are, as I said, eternal human themes, you know, the longing for homecoming, the loss of a beloved companion. You know, these are things that modern novels address too. And I feel like there can be such wonderful dialogue between the modern world and the ancient world. I think that I mentioned Emily Wilson's translation. I think she does a great job of sort of highlighting, you know, some of the things that we have put aside. For instance, you know, in the Odyssey, it's traditional to call the women that Odysseus orders killed at the end, the ones who have been sort of apparently, according to report, sleeping with the suitors,
mm-hmm.
And it's traditional to call them the maids. And that word in English means something really different than the Greek word means. I mean, the Greek word means a female slave. And maid in English doesn't really have that slave thing. And so I think a lot of people have been reading that for years and kind of not really getting, you know, these are women who would have had no consent, no ability to give consent. You know, this is a really dark moment when this happens. And these women are slaves. They have no recourse. They have no power. And, you know, they're being killed for basically something that, you know, they were already had no power to control one way or another. And so Emily Wilson, in her translation, doesn't use the kind of traditional English translation maid. She says female slaves. And so just little things like that, you know, I think you can really open up the dialogue about these stories and sort of say, you know, let's think about, yes, we love Odysseus's story, but what's the experience like for some of the other characters in the story? You know, can we look at kind of broader issues about, you know, oppression and all that stuff. And it's all in there. You know, the ancients were incredibly wise. And so I think teachers can tease all that out. And to me, when I teach these stories, it, you know, my students are always blown away because they go in thinking that it's going to be boring and they come out completely jazzed and excited and inspired because it's not boring and it's fresh and exciting. So I would love to see, you know, I would love to see them hold a place and, you know, but for teachers to really approach them not as, you know, this is a historical relic, this is this old thing that we all have to learn, but as exciting, new, with evolving scholarship, you know, something that people are still engaging with and that can speak to modern works as well.
Yeah, we absolutely agree here at the Hellenic American Leadership Council with all that you've said. And we've stressed multiple times the importance of the classics. And one of the reasons we've asked like people like Barry Strauss and yourself to speak to us about their work is because we think that, like you said, there's so much to learn from it. And these texts are foundational to our Western civilization.
Absolutely.
So you can't push them aside and hope to understand where we've been and where we're going without them, I think.
Absolutely. And, you know, and there's, I mean, I think you could teach a wonderful course just on reading Homer and then reading responses to Homer from all over the world. I mean, that's what's amazing is that these texts have had such a long and varied cultural history. As you say, they are foundational for so much of Western and international thought.
To bring it back to your books, I think that adaptations are a fantastic way for people to get acquainted with the material, because sometimes the original text seems a little daunting. And once that fire is kindled, you can take a step back and look at the original and really appreciate it. So I want to recommend everybody to, if you haven't picked it up yet, pick up The Song of Achilles and Circe and reacquaint yourself with Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey from a new perspective. Thank you again, Madeline, for joining us. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you.
It is my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for the work you're doing to keep these texts vibrant.
And I want to finish off with a short reading from a book of your choice. I know we discussed this earlier, so we're excited to see what you've selected.
Sure. So I'm going to pick a section from towards the middle of Circe, after Circe has already started turning men to pigs. And the he in this passage is Odysseus. He asked me once, "Why pigs?" We were seated before my hearth in our usual chairs. He liked the one draped in cowhide with silver inlaid in its carvings. Sometimes he would rub the scrolling absently beneath his thumb. "Why not?" I said. He gave me a bare smile. "I mean it, I would like to know." I knew he meant it. He was not a pious man, but the seeking out of things hidden, this was his highest worship. There were answers in me. I felt them very deep as last year's bulbs, growing fat. Their roots tangled with those moments I had spent against the wall, when my lions were gone and my spells shut up inside me. After I changed a crew, I would watch them scrabbling and crying in the sty, falling over each other, stupid with their horror. They hated it all, their newly voluptuous flesh, their delicate split trotters, their swollen bellies dragging in the earth's muck. It was a humiliation, a debasement. They were sick with longing for their hands, those appendages men use to mitigate the world. Come, I would say to them, it's not that bad. You should appreciate a pig's advantages. Mud slick and swift, they are hard to catch. Low to the ground, they cannot easily be knocked over. They are not like dogs. They do not need your love. They can thrive anywhere, on anything, scraps and trash. They look witless and dull, which lulls their enemies, but they are clever. They will remember your face. They never listened. The truth is, men make terrible pigs.